Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming to the Alaska World Affairs Council Ambassador Series. I'm Cheryl Myers, and I'm on the Board of Directors for the Alaska World Affairs Council. I'm filling in for our fearless leader, Lisa Falsco. And for those of you who know Lisa, she's quite a triathlete, and she's escaping from Alcatraz this weekend, so she can't be here. So I'm filling in for her. If you could take a moment to turn off your cell phones, this program is being recorded. For listeners at home, we have Will Thier recording our program today. Thank you, Will. The program will be available online as a podcast next week at alaskapublic.org, so you can download the podcast. We are a membership organization, and if you're not a member, we would encourage you to join so we can continue to bring wonderful programs like today's up to Alaska. We are accepting renewals at this time as the memberships expire at the end of this month. And if you join now, we'll give you all of next year and this month for the price of one membership. It's too late to apply for your PFD at this time. However, you can still donate money to the Alaska World Affairs Council through Pick, Click, and Give, and you can make those changes until the end of August. We're especially honored today to have the Lieutenant Governor in the attendance. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, would you please stand up? If this is your first Alaska World Affairs Council program that you've attended, could you please raise your hand? Oh, wonderful. Lots of new faces in the audience. Thank you very much for attending. We hope you enjoy the program today. If you like what you hear, we hope we'll see you in the fall. We have an ambassador series that we run through the summer, and then we have regular programs through the fall and winter. If you're a student, could you please stand and be recognized? It's great to see all you students here today, and we'd also like to thank BP, who generously pays for all the students' lunches. So let's hear a round of applause for BP. Today's meeting is our annual meeting, and our annual report is available at the front desk, so please take a look at that. I'd like to now introduce the head table. To my far left is Greg Wolf, Executive Director of the World Trade Center Alaska, one of our partners in today's program, and former board member of the Alaska World Affairs Council. Next to Greg is Chuck Becker, who is the Vice Chair of the Export Council. They're another partner in our program today, and he's a board member emeritus of the Alaska World Affairs Council. Next to Chuck is Dan Sullivan, the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Next to Dan is Berent Gutchoff, the Honorary Consul of the Federal Republic of Germany for the state of Alaska. And last but not least is our ambassador, and we will hear more about him in just a minute. I'd like to bring Dan Sullivan up to the podium. He is personal friends with the ambassador, and he's going to tell a tale or two about their antics.
So thank you, Cheryl. It's great to be here as a member of the World Affairs Council, but what I wanted to do very briefly today was just say a few words about the special guests that Alaska has today, Ambassador Peter Ammann, and I just wanted to make some connections here because Peter and I got to know each other when we were both representing our respective countries as G8, the Group of Eight Summit, what they call the Sioux Sherpas. And in the world of international summit diplomacy, G8 summits, G20 summits, US-EU summits. The process is run by what are called Sherpas, who are diplomats who work together very frequently to negotiate joint statements of world leaders. And borrowing from Himalayan mountaineering vocabulary, the Sherpas work in the Sioux Sherpas with the world leaders to prepare them to successfully get to the summits. So that's the terminology. In 2007, Germany was hosting the G8 summit. So Ambassador Ammann, his fellow diplomats, and ultimately Chancellor Merkel were in charge of laying out the agenda for the summit. We spent months preparing for this summit, negotiating every single word of our leaders' rather lengthy joint statement of all the G8 leaders. And this is where I saw Ambassador Ammann in action, as I would say, with no exaggeration, one of the finest diplomats I have ever met. Smart, collaborative, funny, insightful, a leader who somehow managed to enable all the Sioux Sherpas from the U.S., Canada, Japan, the U.K., Italy, France, Germany, and our good friends the Russians, of course, to work together and to negotiate a leader's statement that reflected each of our country's values, goals, commitments, and aspirations. No easy tasks, very strong-willed diplomats, strong-willed countries around the table. He also ably dealt with all the contingencies that occur in the run-ups to international summits. In our case, there were many. Someone leaked the entire draft leader statement to the Financial Times a week before the summit. I swear that was not me, Peter. So Bono and his organization was pressing us to do all kinds of important things for fighting disease in Africa, which we did, very historic, I think. And truly, in many ways, it was a three-ring circus that Ambassador Amon led, handled, and dealt with in the most professional manner that I have seen. And I just want to end by saying I saw something else that I wanted to mention to this audience. Yes, he is probably, look at his resume, one of the most accomplished German diplomats of his generation. The jobs he's held, including ambassador to France, ambassador to the United States, the senior foreign service state secretary position, are all the top jobs. But he is also someone with a deep, deep respect for the United States, American citizens, our values, our place in the world, and the sacrifices we have made over the decades to try to make the world a better place. And I saw this in him every time I worked with him. And trust me, you don't see this in a lot of diplomats around the world. And I saw it in him. So when I heard he was coming, I literally kind of forced myself onto the stage to be able to say a few introductory comments, because it's just a great, great honor to have such a well-respected diplomat, really in the whole world, to be here in Anchorage, Alaska, to talk to us about what's going on with U.S.-German relations and other issues. So I just wanted to thank Peter for coming. Great to see him again, and give you a little sense of what a truly great, great man he is. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Sullivan. Now I'd like to bring Berndt Gutschoff up to the state, to the podium to introduce our speaker.
Well, after this introduction, I'm not sure that I'm still needed. Anyway, ambassadors must have the trust of the foreign minister, and as being ambassador to Washington is the pinnacle of the German Foreign Service, it requires, of course, also the confidence of the Chancellor and her cabinet. Mr. Amon's predecessor was Klaus Chariot, and he had the reputation of being mildly critical of the U.S. and of the U.S.'s involvement in the war in Iraq. And so before he was appointed, he had to convince the Chancellor and her cabinet that he was, in fact, the right person for the job. Of course, he did that because he served with great distinction and was a terrific German ambassador to the United States. Now, the current ambassador, Mr. Amon, does not have this problem. He didn't have to convince anybody, because it was quite clear from his record, and you have heard part of it already, and we'll go through it in a minute here, that he is absolutely the right person for that job at this time. Mr. Amon was born and raised in Germany, of course. He studied physics, math, and economics. Economics I can understand, I did that too. Math and physics is beyond me. But in any event, he received a PhD from the Free University in Berlin in 1978 and joined the Foreign Service shortly thereafter. He started his career, as they all do in the Foreign Service, in various posts and various embassies around the world, and then he started focusing on his expertise, which is economic matters. Again, he served in various capacities. For example, from 1999 to 2001, he was the head of the economic section in the German embassy in Washington, and I believe I got to know him at that time. From 2001 to 2007, he was the Director General for Economics in the German Foreign Office in Berlin. And as you heard, during this time, he was the he prepared Chancellors Schröder and Merkel for G8 summits. He was the Sherpa, as Dan Sullivan described it. And that is an official term, by the way. In looking at various publications, you will find their positions referred to as that. In 2007 and 2008, he served briefly as German ambassador to France, and in 2008, he was appointed State Secretary in the Foreign Office. Now, State Secretary in the Foreign Office is the highest civil service position in the Foreign Office in Germany, and it is essentially a deputy minister position. From that position, he was then appointed as ambassador to the United States, and he arrived in Washington, I guess it was in August of last year. Now, the fact that he came from the State Secretary's office is significant in that the previous three ambassadors had also come from that position. So there seems to have been a tradition that has now been established in Germany that state secretaries move to Washington, D.C., if that post is available. What is new over the three predecessors of Mr. Ammons is that he has the expertise in economics, and that, considering the state of economic affairs and the relations between the United States and Germany at the present time, and the problems which Germany and the EU and the United States are facing in economic terms, I think his expertise is extremely useful both to the United States and to Germany. I met the ambassador last year in Berlin before he was appointed, and he told me then, I want to come up to Alaska as soon as I can after I'm taking on my new assignment. Well, here he is. Within a year, he made good on his promise, and I think that's just terrific for us. His talk is entitled Challenges for German Foreign Policy in 2012. Clearly, one of the challenges is economic, and he will undoubtedly talk about it, and I cannot imagine a better person to talk about that than Ambassador Ammon, so help me welcome him to the podium.
Well, thank you all very much for these kind words and this wonderful reception here. The U.S. was my dream post. I really always wanted to come here, and well, it's the second time I'm posted to Washington. I was, as you said, in a previous position, economic minister in Washington, and then I came back last summer. And I can tell you, it was really a hard fight to get this post. I remember there were people who said, well, why do you want to go to America again? You see, that's the old saying, if you need a friend in Washington, get yourself a dog. I said, I was there and it was just wonderful. I have so many friends. And I said, well, it has changed. Life has become more difficult in Washington. And in the end, one guy said, my advice now is you better get two dogs because the first dog might turn against you. So anyway, I'm in Washington, and I'm there where I always wanted to be. I'm here in America, and my trip here to Alaska is just another dream coming true. And just to give you proof of that, I brought my wife and grown daughter with me. My grown daughter lives in Europe, in London. And so I said, well, buy a ticket from London to Washington, and then you will hop on the plane, and we will go from here to Anchorage. And the flight from London was, I think, 7 or 8 hours. And the flight from Washington to here, with a changing of planes in Denver, I think was 11 hours. So in the end, we felt, now we are really far away from home. Until this morning, I met someone who came in with a German airline, Condor, and he said it's just a 7 hours flight. It's less than Washington. So I think I have to rethink my geography. And we spent the last days here in a national park in Fox Island, and had a trip to the northwest fjord. Wonderful trip, unforgettable, and I can only say it is great to be here, and I'm very happy. More happy even so to meet old friends like Dennis Sullivan. And of course, he is a diplomat because he didn't tell you all the stories that happened when the leaders met. But I can tell you it's quite a rewarding feeling when you sit together with good friends whom you trust, and you work out what the leaders shall say in public. And then you present it to the leaders, and then you have Mr. Putin, President George Bush at the time, Chancellor Merkel, saying exactly what we had agreed among us. Can you imagine what kind of reward that is? But I leave it here. I will not go more in the details. Maybe Dan will tell you more in a long winter evening or so when he's more talkative. I think you expect me to say a few words about the foreign policy issues at stake today. And I can only tell you, I believe that never in the 30 years I'm dealing with foreign politics, I felt that we are in such a profound change of the global scenery as today. And it's the timetable is quite tight. Most of the important things will happen in June this year. Can you imagine? It's very close. What is very close to us now? We have elections in Greece that will decide on the future course of the Eurozone. We have the elections in Egypt on a leader there, which is also quite decisive on, I would say, on which course the Arab world will take. Elections in America, but they are not so critical, I think, as it is in the rest of the world. So we have the transition in China, and it's more than just a generational change of leadership. China is looking for a new, shall I say, business model. And so it's very profound what's happening in the world, and I think later in 10 years' time or so, we will look back at today and say, that's when it all happened. So it's a critical time. And I think we should also be aware that here in Alaska, you may have a feeling of remoteness. You have a wonderful state here. You're rich, you have all natural wealth, you have beautiful sceneries, nice people, friendly people. But you are fairly close. When I said Frankfurt is only 7 hours away or so, less than maybe Beijing. So you are in today's world, we are all connected. And you cannot say that being far away geographically keeps you protected against what's happening in the world outside. So you are part of it. You are in the middle of it. I just remember when the financial crisis broke out and Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. It was not an American crisis that spilled over to Europe. It was just one crisis. And the financial markets in today's world are just one market. The interconnectedness is perfect. There's only split seconds of time for a computer to sell all your shares in one place or the other. So again, distance, geography does not help you. You are in the middle of it. So I slowly would try to move our thinking on the euro crisis. Again, I think that much what is said today and what is written in the newspapers about it is not correct. And I'm fairly angry about many comments I hear from politicians all around the world because, again, financial matters are all about trust and confidence. I'll give you a simple example for that. You can ask yourself, what is a dollar bill? You all know it, $1. And it is a piece of paper, nothing else. But besides being a piece of paper, you trust that you can buy something for this dollar bill. That in the end it means something to someone else. When you hand him a dollar bill, he will give you a piece of cake or whatever you want. So if this trust is destroyed, the dollar bill is nothing but a piece of paper. And in today's world, most of the money is not even in the form of paper. It is a sequence of zeros and ones on a computer somewhere. And so what is money? It mainly is trust. And trust is, as we all know, in all our ways of life, trust is very hard to establish, to build, and it's easily lost. And loose talk in this context is very dangerous. So my advice is to really restrain, everybody should restrain, and I would include myself in this, we should restrain ourselves a little bit and not starting to talk loosely about what's happening. Let me give you some figures. If you see the euro, what's called the euro crisis, it is because of debt. Countries like Greece, Italy, Spain have a huge debt burden. And when you look at the figures, and I brought them with you, sorry, figures are always a bit boring, but it's sometimes useful to look at the figures. In the Eurozone, we have a government deficit on average of 3.5%. The US has, if you have only the federal deficit, 8.5%, and if you include the other levels of government, you come to 10% GDP deficit. So the debt, the accumulated debt in Europe is about 80% of GDP, and it's about 100% in the US. In Japan, it's almost twice that. So the current account, that's the balance of all the exports you have, goods and services, the Eurozone is fairly balanced. They sell as much to the outside world as they import. America has a deficit of, again, more than 3% GDP. So if you would look from Mars on our planet and say, where would you expect the debt crisis to happen, you would probably think first at Japan and not at Europe. We would be the last in the line. The reason why we have it in Europe, first of all, is again a matter of trust. People lost trust that some governments in Europe will pay their debt. So investors who have to invest their savings somewhere, they ask themselves, will I get my money back? And if you buy a Greek bond today, you have more doubts than when you buy an American treasury bond. And of course, this can be explained quite easily, why investors trust more the US and, by the way, Germany, as we trust the other countries. Here in America, you have the Federal Reserve standing behind your currency, and the Federal Reserves in the end, I'm not speaking for the Federal Reserve, but I would assume that if you buy a $100 treasury bond, you could expect to get $100 back when it's due. And the same is not true in Europe, because you have a European Central Bank, which is not standing behind or at least not openly standing behind the debt of all member countries. And you can, of course, say, why don't you do it like we do it? Like, why don't we do it in Europe like we do it in the US or in Japan? And there's a very simple answer. It's like a family that shares a credit account, and the credit cards the family member carries all draw from this account. So being a father of two grown daughters who have a credit card from my account, I know that you have to put a limit to that. You have to tell them, well, you have a certain limit, and then if you go beyond that limit, there will be no money coming from this credit card. So this doesn't exist. In a way, countries like Greece, they were overspending. The Greeks had pensions which were simply too high. compared to the underlying economy, they have deficits in their administrative structures, for example, when you come to the tax collection system in Greece, it's not working well, or land registries are not working well. So all these things that you need to make an economy working are missing. And so it's not quite surprising that in the end the Greeks maxed out their credit card, so to speak, and now they have a problem. Other countries came to this on a different trajectory. The Irish, for example, they had a banking crisis. They had to bail out their banks, and the money, the sums they needed to bail out their banks were gigantic. So they spent more on bailing out their banks than they could afford, in a way, and then they had to get support from the other European member states. Spain is a different, again, it's a, maybe it's a bit of a mixture of the two other cases. Spain had a real estate bubble, which was really exuberant. I think there was a time when more houses were built in Spain than in the rest of Europe. So now one wonders who shall live in these houses and who shall pay for it. It was all built on borrowed money. So what do you do with these houses now? And of course, what do you do with the workers who built the houses? It was, I think, 1 million people employed who are now unemployed. So it is a matter of reorganizing your economy, and whenever you do this, you have to hurt vested interests. It's not easy to tell a pensioner in Greece that his pension is 30% too high compared to comparable countries, or if you have invested your money in a Spanish bank and the Spanish bank now is in difficulties because the houses for which we handed out mortgages are now worthless, or at least they are underwater, I think that's the term you use here in America. And of course it's very hard to tell the investor, look, you have to accept a haircut. So there's a lot of political resistance to any reform. And what's happening in Europe right now can be really boiled down to a very simple formula. Everybody agrees that the countries in Europe have to reform their administrative structures, the way they do business. And the voters in these countries are not liking it, of course. And the Germans are in a different, we are in a different position because we changed course earlier. We discovered earlier than others. That's the only good thing to say about us, I think, here. We discovered earlier than others that we cannot live on borrowed money beyond our means forever. So we changed course earlier, maybe 5 years or so earlier than the others. And now all the money in the world is flowing to Germany. So everybody is trying to put his investments into German bunds, and we pay them 0% interest now. But the money is still coming because they think it's safe in Germany. What we do is we have set up huge sums of German taxpayers' money, which are buying time for the other Europeans. It's like financial life support. We told the Greeks and the Irish and the Portuguese, look, we will borrow you money. We will lend you money, so you don't have to go to the market for the next 2-3 years, and you can get so you have time to reform your structures. And people take the money, but they are, of course, some are unhappy if they shall really do these reforms. And that's what the Greek vote will be about on June 17th. Do they want to strike a deal with us, taking our money for 2-3 years, and use the money to be to do the reforms that are necessary, or just go bankrupt. And if they opt for the bankruptcy option, of course, it will be very tough, because the government overnight will find it hard to pay its bills and pay pensions and all the other government expenditure that comes on comes up every day. So I had a conversation with some American senators, which are in Washington the other day, and I explained to them, look, the sums that the German taxpayers set aside to rescuing the other fellow Europeans is about $0.25 trillion. $0.25 trillion. Now, the American economy is four times the German economy. So compared to the US, or imagine that the US Congress had to give a vote on a rescue mission for another country and vote that $1 trillion of taxpayers' money should go to Mexico or any other country. And all the senators around my table said, well, we would never do that. There was one who even said, we would not even give this to California. So it's fairly generous, but we cannot, of course, continue to or accept a regulation that would make transfers of these of magnitude permanent, that the Greeks and the others would live beyond their means forever. In my example, if I tell my daughters, I will simply pay your credit card bills, whatever the sum is, I think that this will be very dangerous. Even if I'm a well-off person, in the end, they would spend so much that it would go beyond my possibilities, and in the end, I would end in bankruptcy, probably. Yeah. Well, I like my daughters. They are kind girls, but knowing them, I think the comparison shows that we have to do a number of steps in the same time. We have to do reforms in the countries concerned, in Italy and Spain, and some of the countries are doing that very impressively. Italy is undergoing a reform process that is really remarkable. But we all know, if Mr. Monti, who's the Prime Minister of Italy, would have an alternative to doing all these reforms, then overnight he would, of course, be more generous and spend more money than he has, because if the money would come from somewhere else, from heaven or from Germany or from I don't know where, he would, of course, do it, because the voters would expect him to do so. Or if he would say, well, I think austerity is the right thing to do, then and he could afford a different strategy, then the voters would simply vote for somebody else. So it's not only an economic issue, it is also a political issue, and the two are connected. We have to keep an eye on both elements. Austerity is not an end in itself. Some newspapers, also here in America, said, well, the Germans are somehow freaks. They love austerity. We love it as an end in itself, and it has to do with our Calvinistic past, or with some strange soul searching. And my answer here is that, of course, we have to live within our means, but in the same moment, we have to pursue a growth strategy. But growth will not come by going deeper into the red. More debt will not solve the problem in Germany and in Europe, but we have to do what we call structural reforms. We have to have more investment. We have to do more in education. We have to liberalize labor markets and the like. Spain has a very high unemployment, a worrying high unemployment. I think it's now standing at 25%. But most people don't mention in the context that it was almost that high in days when the money was flowing in. So they always had very high unemployment, even in the good times. And the unemployment is high because they have labor market regulations that make it very unattractive for an investor or someone who runs a company to employ someone, because once you have employed someone, you will never get rid of him or her. So this is a regulatory problem that has to be addressed in these countries. And of course, we say, well, if you want to solve your problem, we can tell you where you have to where you have to go, where the problem lies. But of course, the choice, the work is yours. So part of the the assistance treaty which we have set up, I mentioned these huge sums of money which Germany and some other North European countries have put together to buy time for reform. Part of the deal is what we call a fiscal compact. It is a treaty which is entering into force, hopefully now in summer, again, June, July, very close to the present, that will oblige all member states to live within their means, to put it simply, non-technical, to have limited deficits in their in their households, and so accept a credit card limit. And thirdly, we want to have a growth component. That, of course, is fairly complicated, but it is a policy which will support growth strategies in these countries and help them build up a prosperous economy. So, in the end, the euro crisis is, I think, it's a crisis of choice and a crisis of trust. It's, the question is, do you want to, do the voters in the countries affected by the crisis accept that we have to live within their means? I hope the answer is yes, but we will see in the coming weeks. And I'm fairly sure that once this decision has been taken, trust will return. So in the end, I'm optimistic that what we describe as a euro crisis here now in the US will at least become better in the coming months, but not because someone opened the floodgates of the European Central Bank and just started to print more money, but because of necessary reforms that will be implemented soon. I think I leave the euro crisis here. Of course, if you wish so, we can discuss more details in the Q&A session. But I think there are more important trends in the world which we should simply at least mention. One, of course, is the Iran crisis. The Iran crisis really is frightening. And of course, there is a diplomatic effort now underway, a very serious diplomatic effort to resolve it. Just to set the basics straight, there's a huge agreement among everybody that Iran may not have a nuclear bomb. So this is something we all agree on. The question is, how can we force them to give up their ambitions to build one? And for the first time, we really have we have biting sanctions in place. Iran is a country that imports a lot of the stuff it consumes. The only sensible export they have is oil and some cashew nuts, I think. But this is not really important. And we, from July 1st, again July, within a month's time, the European Union will stop buying Iranian oil. And that goes even beyond Europe, because most of the insurers that insure the tankers that bring oil from Iran to Korea and other countries are sitting in Europe, and they cannot insure this anymore. So there is a lot of pressure building up, and you can easily see how strong the pressure is when you look at the exchange rate of the Iranian currency, the rial. It lost almost two-thirds of its value recently. That means that everybody is worried, and people think that they can no longer afford to buy the stuff they need for their daily lives from abroad. So this is a tough game, but I think all alternatives to the diplomatic solutions that, or diplomatic effort which is on the way, all alternatives would be very nasty. I think you just here in America you have seen the Iraq war. Took you years, and it were bitter years, I think. And I don't believe that there is a quick and easy short solution for in a military option. It would be nasty, but it only encourages, I think, everybody to work on a diplomatic solution, even if it's difficult. But again, here we have had a meeting, a negotiating meeting in Baghdad recently with the Iranians, where we produced our demands, our technical demands, giving up their enrichment to 20%, bringing the 20% enriched uranium out of the country, and have a full inside inspection inside in what's happening in Iran. So we now know what we want in detail. And the next meeting is again on the 17th of June in Moscow, and then we will hear what they say to that. And we made one point clear: we will not accept a strategy that will play for time. The Iranians are very good negotiators, by the way, and they are very good at playing for time. So we will not accept this. And you know, there is a group of the five permanent members of the European, of the United Nations Security Council, the US, China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany as the sixth member on the one side, and the Iranians on the other side negotiating. And so I hope here again that in the end the Iranians will accept to enter into a bargain with us and deal with us, and that we will have this terrifying problem solved. I briefly mentioned China. Of course, everybody here, I think you are looking over the Pacific much more than people on the East Coast do. There's a profound change underway in China. It's a generational change, a new leadership coming in. But it is also a time where, well, of course, some numbers which were below expectations, growth was a bit below expectations recently, some numbers may indicate that there is something more profound going on. And the Chinese system, a communist party running a successful market economy, which is somehow a bit bizarre in a way, was based on a deal. The leadership had a bargain struck with its population. And the population said, "Well, we accept you, leadership. We don't want votes or democracy and all this, but you have to give us growth and a better life in the future. Better life against democracy." This sort of deal. I think I'm not so sure that this deal will continue forever, because you have now people who have become middle class, who have a certain living standard, and as people become richer, they also ask for certain freedoms. Or when the government says, "Well, we want to build a new motorway and we will build it through your backyard." Well, people accepted that in the past, that a bulldozer came overnight, but we don't accept this so much today. In a democracy, you have people who say, "Well, please, congressman, you're representing my interests. Prevent this motorway being built through my backyard." So, I think there's something changing there, and we must see how this how this goes on. The last totally different topic I want to mention, and then I finish, is what's happening in the Muslim world, in the Arab world. You all will remember we were very positive about the first signs of the Arab Spring, and now some people are using different terms. Some speak of the Arab Winter. So let's hope it will not come to that. I think in the end, people have there are two or three big trends. You can see it in Egypt. One is there's a trend towards democracy, and this is what we all found so wonderful about the Arab Spring. And there's another trend that is the restoration of the old authoritarian, often military rulers. You have now in the elections, presidential elections in Egypt, you have a choice between a Muslim brother and a representative of the former Mubarak regime, which was a military-based authoritarian, once some people say dictatorship. Maybe it's a mild dictatorship, but it was not a democracy. So, and the third, of course, is the political Islam, where religion decides what happens in politics. Again, political Islam is not an option that we find so attractive. It seems to be a trend that it's visible in all Arab countries, some more on this side, some more on the other side. Syria is another case, very similar. You have a government which is of the old style, authoritarian rules, and you have opposition coming from people who want democracy, but you have also opposition from people who want Islamism. So it makes it very difficult for us, for the West, to take sides and say what to do to stop the bloodshed. In the end, there are about 1 billion people in the Muslim world. So it's about the same size what we call the Western world. If you take all of the US and all of Europe, and maybe add on Japan, you come to about 1 billion people, and they are as many as we are altogether. So this is a huge, huge part of the world that is seeking a new direction, and whatever comes out of this process will be decisive for our future. I think so. I'm not one of those people who say all this, what I described here, is a perfect storm. We have so many turbulences coming together at the same time. I think there is room for optimism. I think we will be able to solve these problems. But I just want to make the point that America, the superpower, the hyperpower in the world, is not, I think, able to do this alone. You will need partners for that. And again, then, if I were American, I would ask myself, who are my best partners? And then my answer is, look, when America came under attack on September 11th, who went with you to Afghanistan? It was not the Asians. It was the Europeans, although Afghanistan is far out of our world, so to speak. We went with you there and fought with you for 10 years now. Or another example I always like to give is how is the economic relationship across the Atlantic compared to the relationship across the Pacific? Americans always speak about trade. I'm a bit surprised about that. Trade, trans-Pacific trade, is about the same size as transatlantic trade, roughly speaking. But when you look at investment, you have a totally different story. Investment is what brings jobs to America. And when I came here to America, I asked all the German CEOs who are invested here in America to come to meet me, and we discussed the question, what do you want here, what do you expect me to tell the American government? And they told me German investment alone in America has created 750,000 jobs. That's a figure that most people don't know. And when you then ask an American how many jobs might the Chinese have created here in America, they would think maybe the same order of magnitude? And the answer is 1/100 of that. So it's European investment that has created jobs here, not Chinese investment there. Japan is a bit in, more in the European way, but so I would say it's not trade that that is so important for us, but it's investment, and we have to make sure that the regulations we have, that the regulations that govern investment are made in a clever way, so that we encourage mutual investment on both sides of the Atlantic and help us. And I think we, in our last lives, Dan, we have discussed these problems already, and I think we have to go working on that. I will close with coming back to the geography here, and I'm still surprised that Frankfurt is closer than Beijing from here from Anchorage, and after this I feel we are much closer. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have time for some questions. If you have a question, please raise your hand and wait for Eric to come over with the microphone before you ask the question, as we are recording this for the radio. Thanks.
Not to put you on the spot, but do you think Greece will abandon the euro? Can they afford to abandon the euro?
That Europe will abandon the euro?
Greece.
Greece. If I were a Greek voter, I would not do that, because you have countries in Europe, like small countries like Montenegro, who are not part of the eurozone, but who use euros as a means of payment, like some countries use the American dollar as a means of payment. And you have two alternatives. You can, of course, say, I will create a new currency, like a new drachma, if you are a Greek voter. And nobody can expect that the investors who shied away from Greek euro bonds would now buy Greek drachma bonds. This is not thinkable. So in the end, the best would be to become like Montenegro, use the euro, and continue to do your business in euros. But then, of course, it's much more comfortable to be inside the euro system where we are now. So from this sort of Platonian deduction, I come to the conclusion that at least if people look at their interests, they would certainly try to stay in the euro. But politics is not always rational, so.
Thank you very much. I've never heard anybody run over all the world crises and make me feel so comfortable that we're in good hands. Yeah, I have a little bit of an echo of the last question in that. That I heard you talking about the euro crisis and that the solution is that we need to have these countries live within their means. Now, I have no stake in Greece particularly, except it's a lovely place to visit and I wouldn't have want to not be able to visit it anymore. But the living within one's means sort of ignores the fact that we're really involved in a community of buyers and sellers, right? And what you talk about coming living within means raising the unemployment rate in Greece from 20% or whatever it is to 30%, and among young people from 50% to 70% or whatever it is, then you're looking at political and social consequences that really need to be fitted into the economic equation. I don't want to see the revival of the generals or of some sort of a you know, proto-fascist revival coming up and taking over in Greece, and with the echoes it might have in Spain, for example. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. No, I think this certainly would be the wrong way to address the issue. And maybe if I can go a little bit more back in the years, I remember about 5 years ago, a German investor came to see me who had bought a huge chunk in the telecom industry in Greece. And he said his workers in Greece almost get the same salary as in Germany, but the productivity is 1/4, 25%. So we need 4 workers to do the same amount of work that is done in Germany. And this does not work, of course. You cannot get the same salary and just doing 1/4 of the work. So it would be certainly wrong to keep everything unchanged and then say simply you have to live with 50% unemployment. 50% unemployment would be a consequence if the salaries or wages would be as they are today, and they are simply too high. And again, if one figure, the Greek salaries, the wages in Greece have increased 30% over the last 5 or 6 years, and they remained flat in Germany at the time. So you have to go back to a level of salaries that is commensurate with the underlying economy and the way we do their work. And then, of course, you will not have this sort of unemployment.
I have a question. Can you comment on the new German president, Gauck, and whether there will be a change in the course, you know, of the country policy? Because, as I understand, him and Merkel are not in the same boat, so to say, about immigration problems and such. And can you comment on that?
Well, we have a non-executive president, so a German president doesn't have the same sort of powers an American president has. In Germany, the political power more lies with the chancellor. But I think what you're referring to is a debate which is happening all over Europe and also here in America. That is, what is our perception to the changing face of Germany or the changing face of America? With here you had I read an article the other day that for the first time you have less than 50% of all kids that are born are white. So America is changing, and we all are changing. We all are undergoing this process. And some like it, some like it not. How shall we react? Shall we try to integrate them? Shall the Turks that live in Germany all become Germans and sing German Christmas songs under a fir tree? What do we expect them to do? Or shall we have a more diverse society? I think this is a sound debate discussion. We need this sort of discussion. But I'm not here really to give you an answer how this discussion will end. I don't think that anybody could give an answer for the American debate here.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for those excellent comments. Certainly I can tell you that as a person who receives quarterly 401k statements, I personally feel very connected to Europe here. In Alaska, as things have affected those very much. But just to change gears a little bit, I'm an East Asian scholar, so I appreciate your comments on China. But it's been a little over 20 years since reunification has taken place. And I'm wondering, just from your personal perspective, has 20 years been enough? Has that process been completed, or is it ongoing? And what has that been like?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, the other day someone said that we have an East German chancellor and we have an East German president now, so unification means that East Germans run the country. Yeah. But this is a joke only, of course. but in the end, it shows, I think, that it doesn't matter where you come from. And this means we have made an enormous progress in bringing the two parts of the once divided country together. It was a very expensive procedure. The numbers, I think, are sky high. It's about $1 trillion or so. We had to pay from a transfer from the West to the East. And when you travel in East Germany now, you find that the motorways and infrastructure is much better than in the West. And you have many Westerners who say, well, we paid for all that, so why? Well, we want to stop that transfer. But it's amazing. We sometimes refer to this debate in the context of a Euro debate, because people say we have really, we were ready to give $1 trillion to our brethren in the East. Now we are at a point where we should have a similar transfer to the peripheral states in Europe, and this is something you really have to think about it if you are ready to do that. I personally believe that it would not help, that such a transfer would only prolong the agony, because it would preserve the old structures and would make people believe that they can live beyond their means, live with salaries that are not commensurate to their underlying economy. So in the end, it will not help them. But again, this is my personal view. Yeah, sure.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to know if Germany is pursuing advancing natural, not natural resources, but alternative energy sources. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Could you just touch on that for a moment?
Thank you very much. No, the Chancellor has just stated, I think, last week, that she has two big challenges. One is the Euro crisis, and the other is the rebuilding of our energy infrastructure, because after the Fukushima event, the German government decided to move out of nuclear energy. We had, I think, 20 nuclear power stations before, and we are closing them down totally because we think that nuclear energy is not safe. May sound differently here in Alaska, because you have such a huge country which is sparsely populated. But Germany, we have 80 million people on a small chunk of land that I don't know how many times it would fit into Alaska. But I can't make a mathematics right away. Nobody wants to live in the backyard of a nuclear power station. I think this is something that people would certainly accept, and so we decided to close them down, and we are investing heavily in alternative energies. We now already have about 20% of our electricity consumption coming from alternative energies, mainly wind energy. If you travel around Germany, you find 10,000, if not 100,000, of these wind turbines on the countryside. It means that we have to, and I think we have a country that has most solar panels in the world. No other country in the world has so many. It's a misty, gray country with little sunshine, but nobody has as many solar panels as we have. So we are really trying to come to, I think, 30-40% of alternative energy by the year 2030. That's the plan. It's very costly. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for speaking to us, and we have a gift for you today. Thank you very much. It's a book on Alaska.
Okay, I thought so. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming today, and please stay tuned to our website for more on our Ambassador Series this summer. Thank you.